Okay, now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Her name is Cheryl. She is, her home group is Sierra Fellowship in Clovis. She is from Clovis, and her sobriety date is March 19, 2005. So let's give her a warm Valley Group welcome.
Hi, you guys. My name is Cheryl, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you. I'm going to share a little bit of what it was like, but I'd like to get into the solution because the solution is what keeps me sober today. I was raised in a normal family. I had one sibling, and that was my brother. He was 4 years younger than I am. There was no drugs involved in my family. My parents drank, but they didn't drink to an excess. And me and my brother both turned out to be drug addicts and alcoholics, and my parents still wonder to this day what happened. Until I got sober, I couldn't explain it, you know, when I was out there. But when I got sober, I learned that this was a disease. And, you know, I brought them as much literature as I could to help them understand that it was not their fault. And today, they're one of my biggest supporters. You know, I used to be an embarrassment to them. And now today, I keep telling them, this is a program of anonymity, because they'll tell everybody, oh, my daughter can help you. You know, she goes to AA and all this stuff. And I keep trying to tell them, it's on the downside, but you know what? It's better than them being embarrassed by me than them being one of my biggest supporters to this day. I didn't take my first drink until I was in high school. I grew up in a small farming community in Dos Palos, and it was a very small school. It took two towns to make up a high school where I was at. I might have taken a sip off of my parents' drink when they left it at a party, and that's about it. But I didn't take my first drink and get drunk till I was a freshman in high school. And I know this is AA, but and I did my first drug then. And I chased that first high and drunk that I got until I got sober, because I could never achieve that feeling I got on my very first time. And it took off from there. I wanted more. And I barely graduated from high school because my drinking and partying took over from there. And once I graduated, I was already bartending when I was 19 years old, and what better way to get alcohol, right? Is bartend. And then my drinking progressed from there. All my friends decided after high school to get married and or further their education, and I'm like, why? That was not my goal. My goal was to party. And I did that exactly as what I did. I was married at 20. I had a daughter by the time I was 21, and I was a widow at 25. And that was due to drugs and alcohol, him dying. And I used that my entire life to drink and use and say, oh, poor me, look at me. And to move forward a little bit, my drinking always went hand in hand with the other substance. And I worked for a family-owned business, and then one day I turned in my keys after I'd stole a lot of money from the family business, and I said, you know what, I'm going on a break. And I'd already had another child, another marriage, and I took that child to his dad's, and I asked him to babysit for the weekend, and then I took my daughter to my parents and asked them to babysit for the weekend, and that turned out to be almost a five-year run. In that 5 years, I probably saw my kid, two children, for about, I don't know, I counted on both hands, you know, let's go with the high amount, about 10 times. In that meantime, when I was on that big run, I was getting in trouble with the law. And there at first, you know, I could always, you know, having a lawyer, get my way out of it or what I could do. And it caught up to me, and I ended up going to prison. And then I became really the black sheep of the family, because nobody in my family, relatives, anything, had ever gone to prison. And when I was sitting there out in Chowchilla, I decided that, you know what, this is not for me. I'm done. I'm going to stay with AA or NA, whatever I was doing at that time when I was locked up. And the day I got released, that thought lasted before I got out of Madera. And I was back doing the same thing that I was doing. And I did that for many, many years. And I had lost my soul while I was doing that. I didn't know who I was. And And to fill that big black hole, I continued to use anything that altered my mind, took away those feelings I had. You know, when I got sober, that regret, that shame, you know, that remorse would start to set in. But the only way I knew how to deal with it was to put another drink in me. And then those feelings went away. I ended up getting some more trouble, and I fought a case for a long time, and I was drinking, and I was still using other substance, and I ended up getting arrested again, and when I did, I found out I was pregnant. So today, I look at that as a blessing, because, you know, I would have kept using and drinking, and the courts don't care, they still send you away, whether you're pregnant or not, and I got sent to do another term, and like I said, I was pregnant, and I ended up having my son in prison, and I got to spend 48 hours with him handcuffed and shackled to a bed. My parents and his father came and picked him up, and I had to go on and do my time, and that son's sitting here in this room today. He is one of us. And when my last parole date is October 4th, 1994, and when I got out then, I said I was not going to use, and I didn't. I have not used since then. But what took the place of my using was my alcoholism. I continued to drink and do the same things I was doing, and hanging around the same crowd and doing the same things. And getting in the same trouble with the courts and the law and everything else. And on my last DUI of many, see, I was a bar drinker and I liked to drive. I was getting arrested for DUIs. I was getting arrested for drunk in public. I was getting arrested for fighting because I'm a very violent drunk. You look at me wrong. You smile at me wrong. You say my name wrong. And I would drink. And then I would fight. You know, I can't remember the last time I was happy when I was drinking. Maybe the thought of, oh, I'm going to drink tonight, I was happy at the end. But I never went in to say I was going to have one because I tried that many times and it never happened. I would stay till closing. I remember going on Wednesday nights, you know, for happy hour and say, I'm going to stop in for one or two. And then, you know, we're on last call. You know, get home, get a couple hours of sleep, and then have to go to work and still be intoxicated. But I was getting in trouble with the law again, and I got this last DUI I got out of several. I fought that case for 3 years because I knew what it was going to entail with my past. And the good old Judge Bremer in Fresno, which everybody hates, told me I had to go to AA with a court card, which I had done many, many times. I've been in and out of the room since the late 80s, always on a court card, always for parole, always for felony probation. And I knew how to find my own court card. I knew how to, you know, go in, put it in the basket, and then leave. And I did that for my first year. And then when it came time, you know, I sat on my hands because I knew what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. I would sit on my hands and I would start, you know, to hear things. And then on the second year of fighting that case, I still had to go to the Alcoholics Anonymous. And there happened to be a meeting by my work within like walking out the front door distance here. And I got sober. But I was only sober of the alcohol. I wasn't sober of the mind. And in that year, I had a lot of people tell me, you'd be better off to go out and drink. Because I was crazier than shit. You know, you take the alcohol out of somebody, and you're still left with you, but you're not working the steps. You're not living the solution, and that's what I was doing. And I continued that for 1 year. And then I went back to court, and the judge says, okay, you have a choice. You can go to jail, you can go back to the prison, or you can go to a rehab. And I looked at the judge, and I said, can you give me 2 weeks? The attorney's looking at me like, what are you, crazy? And I said, no, give me 2 weeks. So after that court date, my attorney says, you know what, I can't represent you because I'm here to get you your best option, and that would be a rehab. And I said, I'm not taking a rehab. I said, I'm going to take jail or prison because I know how to do time. It's not a problem. I went back to court 2 weeks later, and the judge said I did not have a decision, that I was going to be doing rehab, and I told him my insurance didn't cover it, and he says, well, then we'll hurt your pocketbook. We will be going to rehab, and you have to check in by April 1st. I said, okay. So I waited till April 1st that morning to go to a rehab. They weren't going to take me, and I told them, no, you don't understand. My life really depends on this. Not because of my alcoholism, because of my case. And they wouldn't take me, so I sent my ride home, and I sat there in that rehab, and they kept me there till 7 o'clock at night, and then they admitted me. Which I went screaming and fighting. For the first 2 weeks, I tried to tell the counselors and everything how to do their job, and if you're not an alcoholic or you're not an addict, you don't know anything about recovery, you're just book smart, blah, 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 blah. And I had this counselor named Kenny, and he says, Cheryl, I want you to read this piece of paper. And he gave me a piece of paper that had, writing on both sides, and I wish I would have kept it, because Kenny is deceased to this day. He was a counselor, and he was on his Harley, and a drunk driver hit him and killed him. And I read that piece of paper, and it kind of gave me a clue to about alcoholism. Because your biggest fear is step one, Cheryl. And I said, yes, it is. I don't want to admit that my life is unmanageable. I tried for so long to let everybody think that I had it all together. You know, I might be in court, or I might be, doing this or doing that, but I always made sure the outside looked good. You know, you still had the house, you still had the car, I got my job back. I made sure it all looked good, my kids had food in the refrigerator, they had nice clothes, they went to school. But behind that front door, I was lost. And that piece of paper he gave me to read, I read it, and I said, I get it. I get it. It's not about showing a weakness, admitting that I am powerless and my life has become unmanageable. It had nothing to do with what I perceived it to be. It was about my addiction to alcohol. And so after he read that, I went back into my room and I got on my knees. And that was a hard thing for me, because I had given up on God, but God hadn't given up on me. I'd given up on God because why did I go to prison? Why did this have to happen to me? Why did I have a child when I was locked up? Why did I lose custody of my middle son? I had all these whys and buts, and I blamed that all on God. And so once I did that first step on my knees, it was like a fire went off. You couldn't stop me, and my feet have been on the ground running ever since. I got a temporary sponsor, what we're supposed to get when I was in this rehab, and I was lucky enough that the rehab that I was in, they took us by a van to meetings 5 nights a week. And they took us to different meetings, so we would get to see which home group we would like when we got out. And one of our requirements was we had to get a temporary sponsor and call them. So I did find one. And then when I got out, I had a sponsor, a full-time sponsor, within 60 days of me getting out. And I had to test that sponsor, because I thought, I'm not going to tell this person everything I know if I don't trust her. So I would tell her a little, one or two little things about me that nobody knew, and to see if that got around in the fellowship or whatever, that little trust thing we have. And I worked my steps with her to the best of my ability. And she's still sober to this day, but she kind of just vanished away. She wasn't coming to meetings and stuff. And I needed a change. For somebody that was like me, I needed a change, and I knew I needed a change right away, because she wasn't holding me accountable. So I sought out another sponsor. A lot of you guys probably know her, Carrie P. from By the Book. And I'd already been through the book page by page, with Matt G. and with Jack. And so she took me through the book. And she took me through the book no way that anybody else has. I don't know if any of you guys go to Buy the Book or Primary Purpose. You have pink highlighters. You have blue. You have yellow. You have red. And you have to dissect the book. And what she made me do is the first 43 pages of the big book, At the end, she asked me, do I believe I'm an alcoholic? She goes, because if you don't, then we don't need to go any further. And after the page 43, I did believe that I was an alcoholic, because I still had that reservation that I wasn't, because I knew that the drugs had taken me to prison, had taken me to jail, had caused all this havoc in my life, but I really didn't see where the alcohol did until I was taken through this book sentence by sentence. And I could answer that question, yes, I am an alcoholic. And, you know, and then we went on to the doctor's opinion where it talks about the mental and the physical craving. And I really didn't understand that until I read this in the book. Because the first time I read it on my own. It seemed like foreign language to me. I didn't really understand it. I thought it needed to be updated with more current wording. But I could see myself as Bill. You know, if I just put my name where it was his name, I could see myself as Bill. And that's what I needed to understand. And once I got to know what the mental and the physical craving was, I could understand that my mental defense is zero if I take that first drink. The first drink is what's going to lead me to another and to another and to another. And I didn't understand that, why people in the meetings would share or talk about it's the first drink that gets you drunk. I didn't understand. I'm like, hell no, it takes a bottle of Crown to get me drunk. I didn't understand that, you know. And I thought it was just a AA lingo that people were, you know, were talking about. But once I went through this book, it told me that my first drink, I'm going to lose that mental defense and I'm going to continue to drink. And once I got that concept, I understood it. And when I came into the program, my goal was to get 1 year sober. That was it. And once I got that 1 year sober, I was going to take that little 1 year chip to my parents, to my kids, and to the judge and say, here, look at me. And then I thought I was going to be able to go back out and drink like a lady, which I never drank like a lady to start with. But I noticed how my life had changed after the first year. You know, I'm not saying it was all rainbows and flowers and all that, but I noticed how I felt better about myself. I don't fully believe that this little black hole in me was completely full, but I felt better. Things were going a little bit better. You know, my parents would look me in the eye. I could look them in the eye. I could look my children in the eye. And I said, you know what? I'll give it one more year. And I quit going, I'll do it one more year until I reached 5 years. I finally said, you know what? I'm in this for the long haul. Because I still had that little thing, you know, maybe I can. You know, what's one beer going to hurt? What's one glass of Crown on the Rocks going to hurt? You know, I still had that little, that thought. But then I would think it through, you know. So I quit counting after 5. I said, you know what, I'm in here for the long haul. Does anybody besides people that go to buy the book or Primary Purpose know where the first promise is in the big book? It's on the very front page, on the cover, and it says, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. That is our first promise in the big book. Because we are one of those thousands. And if they can do it, I feel that anybody can. You know, like all you guys that came up and announced yourself with up to what I think the highest was 117 days. I remember my first 30 days, which I don't count that 1 year that I sat on my hands and I didn't drink. I don't count that first year. I count my sobriety date is March 19th, 2005, and that's when I actually started working the program. Because I was crazier in hell on that year without the alcohol. You know, and when I was out there drinking and doing what I was doing, everybody in my family would tell me, and a couple of my best friends, I have two friends that have stuck by me through all this, you know, through me being locked up, for me out there causing all this havoc, and then today being sober. I used to tell everybody, you know what, I don't know why you're so concerned. I'm only damaging myself. You know, I'm putting the substance and the alcohol in me, so it's only harming me. And I didn't realize until I got sober that that's not true. Yeah, we might be harming ourselves physically, but mentally, which is worse, we harm everybody that's in our circle and everybody that's in close contact. You know, my parents, I'm just like, wow, I'm surprised you still claim who I am. And today, all they tell me is, you know what, just you keep doing what you're doing. And I think truly this is a family disease that it's inherited because my parents, like I said, didn't drink or use, but I found out that my grandmother was a pill addict. I have an uncle right now that's addicted in his 70s to Oxycontin, which we just found out 6 months ago that he went to rehab and he didn't tell anybody in the family, you know, his sister, which is my mother. But it does happen. And for some reason, I don't know why, my son's one of us. My other son is definitely one of us, but he won't admit it. He always asks me, why aren't you going to have a drink with me? You know? And that son that I lost, and I lost Tessie of, lives with me today. I was not allowed to see him because of my actions and what I was doing. Before his dad passed away, he was already coming around and being a part of our family, and on his choice that we just couldn't tell his father because his father would not allow it. My youngest son right here that just got out of the military is back living with me after I've kicked him out twice. And it's not because I don't love him, it's because my house, we don't drink and use, and he was using. My parents always told me out of my three children, one would be just like me and be my payback child. He's it. And after his last big run, I told my parents, was I ever like that? If I am, God, I'm so sorry. They said, the things I did, yeah, but the words I spoke, no. I just didn't come around, is what I did. I isolated from family, not from everybody else, you know. And it's hard when they know where to come, but you got to let them live their lives and let them do what they got to do. That's the hardest fact, is to step back and just, you hope they live. You know, they make it. And I know that's what my parents, you know, they told me that's what they did. They loved when I went to jail and they got that Quest phone call because they knew I had a bed to sleep in. They knew I had food to eat and they knew I was safe. Because when I wasn't in jail or locked up in statewide, they never knew where I was at. I would check in maybe 45, 60 days, you know, and they tell me, nope, you're not clean and sober, you can't come over. And like they told me, God, you know, when you were in jail, we were happy. That's sad to say. But we knew you were safe. And I'm like, Mom, there's just as much stuff in jail as there is on the street. But, you know, I know today, for me, I have to keep in this book. I have to work with my sponsor. I have to sponsor people. Because when I sponsor people, I get to go back and live in this book, too. And I have to go to meetings. You know, the last couple of years, I kind of slacked off on my meetings. I was maybe hitting one a week. And then I felt that it was just that I had this resentment against my home group, so I started going to other fellowships and going to meetings. And then I realized I'm not going to let somebody else ruin my sobriety because I don't like what they say. I don't like what they're doing. And then I had to reflect, which is written, I have three big books, and the Set Aside the Prayers written on the face of all my big books. And you can use that for any situation, any person that you want to use it for. Just put their name in there or the fellowship in there. And I had to go back and realize that if I'm going to let somebody's personality ruin my meetings where I have to go and get fellowship, recharge my battery, then I'm not working a good program and I'm not spiritually fit. So in the last 8 months, I've been up in my meetings again and working with my sponsees, which I just love doing because I love to see when they come in new and they just blossom, which I didn't think was true when people would tell me, Cheryl, you've changed, you know, your wording, the way you act, the way you talk, you know. Because I came in with a prison mentality, you know. I didn't want nobody to talk to me. I didn't want none of you to know my story. You know, what I did was none of your business. But as we get more sobriety in us, we learn that our story is our biggest asset because we're going to be able to relate to somebody else. You know, they're going to hear what you have to say about your experiences, and they're going to be able to say, hey, you know, what did you do in this? And it kind of shook me up there a little bit. You know, I don't know if any of you guys know Jerry Llewellyn, who has passed. He singled me out in a meeting when I was 6 months sober, and I went up to him and I said, Jerry, I go, you talk about your past. I think he did 20 years in San Quentin, about 20 years in San Quentin for murder. And I said, you're so open and you let people know where you, what you've done and where you've been. I don't want nobody to know that, you know, where I've been and what I've done. I wasn't raised like that. And he goes, no. I will see you here next Wednesday, and you're going to share the meeting for me, and you're going to share where you've been, because one day that will be your biggest asset for you. You won't be ashamed of it. And that's when I learned I need to share my whole story and not pull nothing back. And then when I got Carrie as my sponsor, because I held some things back on my step work with my first sponsor, and that stuff almost ate me alive because I swore there were things I was going to go to my grave with. I didn't want anybody to know because I didn't want you to look down on me. And with Carrie, she brought that out in me. And the freedom that I felt by getting those last three secrets out was a relief that I didn't even know existed. Because I'm free of that bondage now. Of that mental thing that I always know what I did and I haven't turned that part over to God. I am on my third sponsor now. I feel that it's not because I didn't like my past sponsors, and like I tell my sponsees, whenever you feel like you need to let go of me, that's fine because I've taken you as far as I can take in you. I just feel that I needed to grow in another aspect, so I got another sponsor, and I'm being taken through the book again, working more steps. But since I was 6 months sober, my greatest joy was doing H&I work. I started going in and doing panels at rehabs and sober livings and stuff. And I would keep bugging Paula at Sierra Fellowship because she was in charge of the jail panels. She goes, Cheryl, you have to be sober at least 2 years and out of the system 5 years. And I go, I've never been sober 2 years, and I've never been out of the system for five, let alone two. She goes, you'll get it. So that was my goal that I worked for. But before I could go into the jails, I got to start going into the prisons. I was going into Pleasant Valley, Avenal, because then you only had to have 6 months sober and 2 years out of the system. And 2 years ago, I got a phone call from Chowchilla Prison from the warden, which was kind of a scary call. I'm thinking, what is there, you know, something outstanding on me? I got this call from the warden. She goes, I was given your name by our reentry coordinator, and we are having a unity day, and we would like you to be our main speaker. I'm like, really? I go, I can't get in. You've turned me down. She goes, what do you mean? I go, I was housed there twice. If you can get me in, I'd love to be there. Well, the warden can do anything. She got me in, and I got to go in there. And once I got cleared and I walked through the gate and I was in the cage before they open you up to the main yard, I sat there and I bawled. And I had goosebumps up and down me. And the guards were going, come on, we need to go, we need to go. And I goes, just give me 5 minutes. Because I did my little prayer. And the guard goes, what was that all about? And I go, I've come full circle. He goes, what do you mean? I go, I was housed here. I had a child here. And now I'm here. And I get to leave. And that right there was the best feeling I could have. You know, and now I get to continue to go on there And I go at least twice a month on Wednesdays, and I get to go to every yard, and I get to talk to those ladies and share my experience, strength, and hope, and let them know that there is hope for us. I was there. There is hope. You know, we're not labeled. We're not doomed. Everybody has a story, and it takes what it takes for us to get where we're at. And today, I'm not ashamed of my past. It takes what it takes for me to get where I am today. And I truly believe if I wouldn't have got into the trouble that I had gotten at, I'd still be out there. I truly believe that. With the closing, I'd like to, I've never heard this done this way, and I would like to bring this up. Wait a minute, before I do that, I'm going to call on you there, Albert. Does anybody, besides anybody that goes to the big book, know where the last promise is in the book? What the last promise is? Nobody's read their big book? You know, Bill? The last promise in the big book. The last promise is we will suddenly realize that God's doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. That is the last promise in the big book when you read the big book. When I was standing out front, Bill introduced me to Albert. And they say you can't keep what you got to give it away. And I've never seen it done this way. This lady was walking by with a box of donuts. He asked to see what was in it, and he grabbed the donut out. He says, you got to give it away to keep it. And I'm like, do you know that girl? And he goes, nope. And I'm like, I have never, ever seen that before in my life. So thank you for teaching me a new way to give it away. Thank you.